My name is Lucian Popa, and I'm going to tell you about building extensible networks with rule-based forwarding. This is joint work with Norbert Egi, Silvia Radnasamy, and my advisor, Jon Stoikan. So we start from the observation that a network's core functionality is to forward packets. And thus, the power of a network can intuitively be seen as equivalent to the flexibility of its forwarding plane. And many have pointed out that the current internet lacks flexibility, and there have been many proposals to change that and make the current internet more flexible. So what do I mean by flexibility? Today, I take a packet, I put a destination address on it, and the network routes it to a destination. I cannot say something like route around this failure or send the packets to an intrusion detection system before sending them to me. Or I cannot say the network send only a part of the packets to an intrusion detection system and send the others directly to me for performance reasons. And there are many other such examples, like source routes, like multiple paths, like mobility or active networks. So this is what I mean by flexibility. And typically, what flexibility means is using more general forwarding directives, whereby a forwarding directive we refer to the instructions given to the network on how to forward packets. So our work shares this goal, but where we differ is that we argue that flexibility alone is not enough, because flexibility can compromise, for example, network security. Source routing can be used to violate ISP policies. Active networks can be used to run unwanted code inside the network. So our thesis is that flexibility must be balanced by policy support, and that every forwarding directive can be constrained by the policies of the entities that are affected by that directive. So if I can do something that affects you, you have to be able to say no. So let me illustrate this with a real-world example. Let's assume we have a world where only the owner of the car can drive that car. Clearly, this would be an inflexible world. For example, you couldn't give your kid the car to go to school, like my father used to do that when I was in high school. Rarely, though. So clearly, this would be inflexible. So let's try to make this world a more flexible one. So in a Berkeleyan world, anyone could drive any other car. So clearly, this would be flexible. This would be a paradise for drivers. But it would be a nightmare for car owners. So clearly, this won't work either. So in practice, for flexibility to work, one can drive some other one's car only if it's approved by the owner of that car. So what we're trying to do is to bring this common sense principle to the internet. So let me go back to forwarding. So what we mean by our thesis is that every entity that explicitly appears in a forwarding directive can refuse that directive. So let me give you some examples from the internet. So let's apply our thesis to the current internet. The forwarding directive of the current internet is to send the packets to a destination. The entity that appears in this forwarding directive is the destination. And the policy of the destination could be, for example, not to want to receive packets from a specific source. This policy is not respected today. And there have been many works that identify this as one of the main causes enabling the ability to mount denial-of-service attacks. So, and there have been many works, such network capabilities and in-network filters, to try to fix this. In another example, the current IP specification already allows the ability to use source routes. And by source routes, the source can partially or completely specify the path of the packet. However, unfortunately, this can be used to violate ISP policies. And since ISPs have no way of constraining these forwarding directives, most ISPs simply drop the packets that have the source route option. So this is already existing flexibility that, since it cannot be constrained, it is dropped inside the network. So ideally, what we'd want is that every ISP along the path would approve the packet's path. And if any of the ISPs does not approve this path, the packet should be dropped as it enters the network. In yet another example, in case of the middle box, both the source, the middle box, and the destination have to approve forwarding packets along this path. And in particular, for example, the middle box have to approve to relay the packets from the source to the destination and also to offer this traffic its higher layer functionality. Otherwise, the packets should be dropped before reaching the middle box. So this is what I'm going to call policy compliance in this talk. So our goal here is to devise an architecture that is both flexible and policy compliant. And by flexibility, I mean the ability to control the path, the ability to use in-network functionality and in-network state when forwarding for the endpoints. And by policy compliant, I mean that the policies of all the stakeholders involved in forwarding are respected. And our solution is based on this new idea of a packet rule. So the rule contains a set of forwarding directives and is carried in packets. In the current internet, the packet is sent to a destination, which is the forwarding directive of the current internet. In the rule-based forwarding, the packet is sent to the rule, which contains the forwarding directives. And the rule tells the network how to forward packets. In our previous example, the rule says that if the packet port is 80, send the packets directly to the destination, otherwise send the packet through the middle box. Therefore, rules tell the network how to forward the packets. And in order to ensure policy compliance, all the rule participants need to authorize the rule. So in our previous example, both the middle box and the destination have to approve this rule in order for it to work. And since, as we shall see in our architecture, all packets carry rules, rules also tell the network which packets can be forwarded. And now that rules naturally tie in flexibility and policy compliance, because rules specify flexible forwarding directives, because policies are defined on the entire rules, on the entire forwarding behavior of the packet, and because, as you shall see, the rules encapsulate a proof of policy compliance. Thus, since rules are carried in packets, routers only need this information in the packet header to forward the packet and to, in a flexible manner, and to verify that the packet complies with the policies of all the parties. Next, I'm going to present an overview of the rule-based forwarding architecture. Then I'm going to describe the forwarding mechanism. And finally, I'm going to present a set of evaluation results. So in our rule-based forwarding architecture, rules are owned by destination. Know that in other architectures that can use this concept, rules can be also owned by other entities, such as, for example, sources. And in order to guarantee policy compliance, rules are certified by trusted third parties, which we call rule certifying entities. And all the entities that are named in the rule, the destinations, the middle boxes, the routers, must authorize the rule. And after verifying these authorizations, the rule certifying entity signs the rule. The destination inserts this rule into an extended DNS, a DNS that it extended to return the rule of the destination instead of its address. Sources obtain this rule from the extended DNS, insert rules in packets, and some of the routers, the trust boundary routers, need to verify the rule signature, while the RBF routers need to follow the rule directives when forwarding. And I'm going to present evaluation results on this at the end of the talk. And also know that packets may contain a return rule for the traffic to be returned back to the source from the destination when therefore, the RBF architecture comprises of a control plane, which has distribution infrastructure and the certification infrastructure, and a data plane, which specifies how packets are forwarded through the network. And in this talk, I'm going to focus on the data plane, and you can find information about the control plane in our paper. Before going into the rule forwarding mechanism, I want to mention the assumptions on which RBF is based. So first, RBF assumes the use of an anti-spoofing mechanism. And this is because we want to ensure policy compliance. And for that, we need a way to uniquely identify all hosts that are in the network. And RBF assumes ingress filtering for that, although other options are possible. Second, RBF relies on the existing of rule certifying entities and the distribution of RCE keys to routers. And I'm not going to present details on this in this talk, but at a high level, there are several ways you can imagine these RCEs. They could be large entities, very sign-like with a distributed presence, or they could be deployed based on AS boundaries. And finally, rules assume that the distribution of rules is well provisioned against denial of service attacks. And this is because we want to enable a protection against denial of service attacks for the end hosts themselves. So, it got stuck. So what is a rule? A rule is a sequence of actions that can be conditioned by if-then-else statements of the form. If condition, then perform action 1, else perform action 2. And the condition is a comparison operator based on packet header and router state. And as we shall see, we call these attributes, packet attributes and router attributes. And the actions can be to modify the packet header, to drop the packet, to forward the packet, or to invoke upper layer functionality. And RBF is deployed on top of a routing control layer, and we assume IP for this purpose. So an RIP router has a forwarding has an IP forwarding engine and a forwarding information base. An RBF router has an extended forwarding layer with an extra layer on top, which is formed by a rule forwarding layer and a set of router attributes, as well as optionally with a set of specialized functions such as intrusion detection, multicast, or caching. But note that these functions are controlled by ISPs and middlebox owners and not by endpoints. Examples of router attributes are the router's address, its current queue size, or indicating whether the availability of a specialized function. And note that rules cannot modify the value of these attributes. Let's assume that a packet arrives at such a router. The packet contains a rule, a set of packet attributes, and the RBF attributes are the current 5 tuple in the IP packets, the source and destination addresses and ports, as well as a set of attributes that can have arbitrary semantics associated with them. For example, to indicate whether the packet has visited a mailbox. And rules can modify the value of these attributes. Now, the rule forwarding engine applies the packet rule. And the rule can modify the packet attributes. For example, the rule could record the congestion along the path. So each router has a router attribute that indicates its current congestion level, and the packet records that in a packet attribute. Rules could drop packets. For example, a rule could specify that only a specific set of sources are allowed to send packets, and all the other packets are dropped. Rules can forward the packet, and the simplest example is basically a unicast rule. And rules can invoke higher layer functions. For example, rules could invoke caching functions at some of the enhanced routers on its path. And also note that each rule has an associated lease period, and routers drop packets with expired leases. And I'm not going to present details on this. You can check our paper for more details. Now I'm going to present a few more examples. So let's assume that the destination wants its packet to go through an indirection waypoint before reaching it, for example, to select across multiple providers if it is multi-homed. And this is an example of a rule that can achieve that. The rule has a packet attribute bin to R1. And initially, that packet attribute is set such as the first part of the rule is applied and the packet is sent to R1. At R1, the packet attribute bin to R1 is set to 1, and then this part of the rule is applied. To transform the previous rule from a simple waypoint into a middlebox rule, one line needs to be added to invoke the functionality at the middlebox. And in this case, we assume it is intrusion detection functionality. And now that the malicious user could set the attributes such that to appear that the packet has visited the middlebox. And in case the middlebox is used for security purposes rather than performance, the destination may want to prevent against this behavior. So in this case, the rule could simply check whether the packet is indeed coming from the middlebox, and by verifying whether the source address is that of the middlebox, and this relies on the anti-spoofing mechanism. Or it can use stronger cryptographic functionalities. And in this case, the middlebox has to implement a functionality that creates a proof for a packet or a batch of packets that it has they have visited it. And the destination has to implement a functionality to verify these proofs before delivering the packet. And also note that by prepending a condition to all of these rules, we can make them more flexible. For example, to send only part of the packets through the middlebox. And in the last example that I'm going to present, rules can be used to prevent and mitigate denial of service attacks. For example, the destination can create what we call capability-like rules. So a rule that only allows traffic from a specific set of sources. And by controlling the number of currently active rules, the destination can effectively control the number of clients that can access it, and in this way protect against denial of service attacks in a similar way to network capabilities. And now that this relies on a way to dynamically grant rules, whereas DNS is typically a static resolution mechanism, as well as to provision this service against denial of service attacks, because otherwise the attackers could simply attack the distribution mechanism. And I'm not going to present details on this, but at a high level, the DNS could redirect this request to a third party that provides this service. So I've presented a set of examples, although RBF could be used to implement many other examples, such as mobility, such as multiple paths, and anycast. So what are the properties of the rules that I've presented? First, I hope I've convinced you that rules are flexible through the examples presented, but what rules enable are to block unwanted packets inside the network, to control the path using waypoints, to use router state in forwarding decisions and record this state, as well as to use specialized functions and middle boxes and routers if available. Second, rules are policy compliant, as they are certified by trusted entities that verify the policy compliance of all of the entities involved in the rule. And also, rules are deployed on top of a routing control layer. And therefore, route discovery and route computation remain fully controlled by ISPs. And finally, rules are safe. They have a bounded forwarding time, as they only use comparison operators and only cannot modify the packet payload. They cannot modify the router state. And also, they cannot amplify traffic. They cannot create network loops or replicate packets. And while rules can invoke specialized functions that can implement complex operations, can modify the packet payload, can modify the router state or replicate packets, these functions are under the full control of ISPs and middle box owners, which can control which rules can access those functions, and also can use resource isolation and resource and access control to prevent attacks. And in this context, rules merely offer policy compliant mechanisms to invoke these functions. Now I'm briefly going to discuss about related work. There is a tremendous amount of related work, but most of the previous work focuses on either flexibility or policy compliance. So there are many works that proposed a more flexible internet, and I'm only going to talk about active networks, which are the flagship of flexibility. And compared to active networks, rule can be seen as simple forwarding directives rather than full-fledged programs. And this allows safety for the network as well as for routers, and also the ability to statically analyze rules, which in turn creates the ability to be policy compliant for multiple parties. And to compensate for the lack of packet processing in rules, rules allow the invoking of specialized functions deployed by ISPs. Compared to other works on policy compliance, RBF adds flexibility as well as multi-party policy compliance. And compared to several works that enable, among others, policy compliance source routing, RBF generalizes the flexibility by, for instance, adding mobility, or adding the ability to use in-network state when forwarding or in-network functionality, as well as enables richer policies based on the entire forwarding behavior. So if, for example, I can refuse a packet if it invokes some functionality inside the network. And finally, I'm going to present some evaluation results. So when evaluating RBF, some might be interested in the size overhead of rules, in the forwarding overhead of rules, whether we can achieve performance isolation between the invoke functions and forwarding, what is the load on RCs, and perform a security analysis. Due to time constraints, I'm only going to focus on the first two in this talk. You can find more details about the others in our paper. So we have implemented a rule compiler that transforms the rules from the form that I've presented in this paper into a binary form that is carried in packets. And this chart presents the rule sizes in bytes for a set of examples. The rule sizes is broken down into the rule encoding, a set of control bytes, and a signature. And we use elliptic curve signatures, which are shorter, and we use around signatures with around 40 bytes in this result. And the takeaway points here are that the overhead of one rule is between 60 and 140 bytes. And the average in our examples is below 85 bytes, which represents a 13% overhead on an average internet packet. And if RSA signatures would be used, RSA 1024, and if the entire signature were to be carried in packets, the overhead would be 27% on an average internet packet. We have also implemented the prototype RBF router, and it is based on RouteBricks, which is a recent software router technology. We test our work on an 8-core Nehalem server that has two dual-port network interfaces. And in order to have performance isolation between the forwarding functions and the functionality when the forwarding functions, the specialized forwarding functions are present, we run them at separate CPU cores. And you can check our paper for more details on that. So this chart presents the forwarding speed for our software router implementation when it's performing no signature verification, assuming it is inside the trusted domain, and when using all the 8 cores for forwarding. And on the y-axis, we have gigabits per second. The light color columns represent RBF on top of RouteBricks, while the dark color column represents RouteBricks alone. And this is for a set of examples for varying packet sizes, while the first column represents a real traffic trace. So the takeaway points here are that rule forwarding incurs little overhead on top of RouteBricks. In the worst case, this is around 15%, but most typically it's well below 5%. And we expect the same to occur for other instances, for example, for network processors. And also note that rules have no overhead for packets larger than 500 bytes, as well as our software router can forward up to 35 gigabits per second for real traffic and even more for larger packets, almost 40 gigabits per second. And finally, since trust boundary routers need to also perform signature verifications for the rules in order to ensure their policy compliance. And typically, the trust boundary routers are edge routers to a trusted domain, which see lower traffic. And importantly, the result of this verification can be cached. So out of a sequence of packets that have the same rule, only the first packet needs to be verified, and all the other packets can use the same entry. And the cache is small and requires exact match lookup. And recent measurements show that packets for new flows, which represents the worst case for rules, assuming each flow has a new rule, represent around 1% of a backbone link's capacity on average, and in the worst case, 5% of the packets. And this is doable with existing hardware and cryptographic processors. And our software router, when performing RSA signatures, which are more amenable to software implementation, exhibited a 10% slowdown when also for real traffic, when also performing these verifications. And more importantly, the signature verification can be parallelized. And the more hardware we throw at this, the more the higher bandwidth links we can support. And typically, these ASICs are very cheap. So in summary, I have presented RBF, which is an architecture that we argue is both flexible and policy compliant. In RBF, packets carry rules. Rules contain forwarding directives. And rules are flexible. They represent if-then-else conditions based on packet and router attributes. They can modify the packet header and use the network functions. Rules are policy compliant, as they are signed by third parties. And rules are safe. They, for example, cannot corrupt router state or amplify traffic. Thank you.
Mike Walfish, UT Austin. So I have a question about your flexibility and your policy compliance. So on the flexibility side, let's say I'm a receiver and my policy is that I want packets toward me to take a particular interdomain path. And then let's say that along the way the packets stop taking that path. Are you able to detect that and have the routers drop that packet earlier in the network?
No. So we do not log. And if the packet, for example, was tunneled through another point in the network, you could use something like verify whether the packet has been for the previous hop, but you couldn't be able to detect, for example, tunneling that goes back on.
It's not about tunneling. It's that if I'm the receiver, I want to make sure that the packet took a particular interdomain path toward me for the same reason that a sender might care about the particular interdomain path. And I'm curious if you can just detect if that doesn't happen.
No, so you cannot detect. If you at the receiver, you could use something like, you have to use something like external stronger cryptographic guarantees in order to prevent that. So our architecture by default, unless you're using some other mechanisms that you invoke on the path, does not allow you to detect whether the packet has indeed been through that sequence of...
Okay, thanks. So my question about policy compliance, you say that you uphold the policies of all of the stakeholders, and it looked to me like what you're actually doing is upholding the stakeholders of all of the waypoints that happen to be named in the rule. So what do you do about the stakeholders who or that aren't named?
That is a very good question. So basically, in a way, we're like overlay networks. So if you think that overlay networks are policy compliant, then we are also policy compliant with the guys in between the overlay networks. Otherwise, we're not.
Not quite, because in an overlay network, often what you're doing is that you've got some, you know, you're running above, say, UDP, and there's a source and a destination that are communicating over a classic IP. You're below that level.
Yeah,
so
but
it's, but it all seems
the,
like...
All the waypoints do agree with that. So in a way,
all the waypoints agree, but what about the entities between, say, any two waypoints? They themselves have policies. They're stakeholders, and it doesn't seem like you even name them, so you can even talk about them.
Yes, we do not name them. So basically, what we do is we allow route discovery to be fully controlled as it is today. So in a way, if you think about those as overlay nodes, the same.
But they're not quite overlay nodes, I guess, is my point. So I don't think about them as overlay nodes.
Well, in a way, since they approve to forward your packet, you could see them as overlay nodes, in a way. So basically, the policies of the... we do not name them, and we do not make sure that they all agree with those policies that all the name points in the rule have agreed upon. But they have the ability to control the path between the points that agree with the rule. So this is what we propose. This is our proposal. And I would argue that we also respect the policies of the guys that are not named, because if all the points that are named agree with the rule, agree with that forwarding behavior, it's like sending...
That if is false. The thing you just said, if they all agree, they're not named, so you couldn't possibly
know what their policies were. What I'm saying is that if all the parties that agree, the parties that are named agree with that, it's like having multiple flows between them. So in that case, the entities between them won't have anything to do anyway. So their policies have to be compliant by default.
Okay, thank you.
We can take it offline. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, I'm Andres from AT&T Research. Quick one by comparison. I just scanned the paper. I didn't find any latency numbers. What does a ping look like? Best case, worst case?
So the latency is not significantly. So you could think of that as negligible, at least in our implementation. So we have some numbers in terms of how many CPU cycles are used by rules, by rule forwarding compared to a typical router. So you could use that, for example, to detect an extra latency.
To extrapolate the latency.
Sorry?
Use those numbers to extrapolate the latency.
I didn't get...
That's fine. Thank you.
So we should not incur any extra latency.
Helen Wang, Microsoft Research. Could you comment on the deployability of your scheme in today's ISPs?
So, for example, we could use the previous paper and deploy it in slices. And so it could be deployed partially at some of the routers, and you can get many of the benefits except the ability to be default off. So you might detect whether the packets are not policy compliant, as we define policy compliance, but you would still receive those packets. Otherwise, so in an initial deployment phase, you could deploy only some of these routers. You could get many of the benefits. And then you could go to a phase where most of the traffic is on this type of routers, and then you have to drop all the other traffic, basically.
Okay, great. Do you think ISPs would have the motivation to deploy your service?
We enable them to offer more services. So basically, we enable them to provide more services to their customers. So this would be an increased ability for them to diversify their offering, which they're currently dumb pipes, and then by having the ability to offer this more flexible, we think they would have this incentive to.
Thanks.
Thank you.